Thank you very much for that. I wonder, as you come to the end of these 10 years, and you know, there's a limited amount of time for you to speak to an audience like this in your present role. Do you have a desire to share and teach and guide more and sort of get more into these last few months? Or will you have a sense of relief soon that you don't have to do this anymore?
That sounds like a coded question about why I packed quite so much into a shortish lecture. And I apologise for that. But I do actually have a genuine passion about sharing what I believe about human beings, about that unfathomable, wonderful mysteriousness that is us. And I guess that's part of what ministers of the gospel bring into their ministry from the word go.
And yet, it's often got you into hot water of you know, one type or another, whether it's Sharia law or the Iraq war, or more recently the coalition's economic policy. So, have there been times where you've thought, I really shouldn't have said that? Or generally, are you the kind of person who thinks you don't do regrets?
Je ne regrette rien. Well, I do regrets, all right, but I just don't think that it'll do to be too cautious in a job like this. You're here, and it's true of any archbishop, you're here to try and say what you believe you've been given to say, by which I don't mean you're a divine inspiration, but to try and share a particular picture of what the world is like, what God is like, which of course leads you into sometimes risky and anything but infallible judgments about particular issues of the day. But you have to keep trying, I think, to preserve the sense of that big picture. And somebody asked me a few months ago on another occasion whether, in this particular case, as a poet, I felt hemmed in by orthodoxy. And I had to say, well, not a bit. I actually find that the orthodox Christian faith is, for me, something that excites me daily, that I really do want to talk about and explore its implications. And one reason for starting tonight with Vladimir Lossky, that household name to all my audience, is I spent four very fruitful years writing a thesis on him many years ago, and he helped me to see that in that particular case, the Eastern Orthodox tradition had immense resources for thinking about the kind of world we now inhabit, and I've never forgotten that or lost sight of it.
But what would you say to people who think that over the years, you know, perhaps you should have focused more on matters within the church rather than, you know, some of your comments on other areas? Because obviously it might well be remembered as for its divisions, your time as Archbishop, than for the bonds.
I dare say, yes. But I can't myself draw quite so clear a line between thinking through what the implications are of my faith for how we approach human beings and human issues and the human beings and human issues themselves. As I say, you make judgments which are risky and which are fallible. You put them out there in the hope that they might be discussed. And I've never thought that the role of an archbishop is to tell people what to think about everything. But as a pastor, as a theologian, as a priest, to try to make sure that in any and every major public discussion, something of this world of understanding and vision gets fed in somehow.
Does that mean you'll be disappointed if your successor as Archbishop of Canterbury, you know, takes a more, I was going to say conservative, but that's definitely the wrong word in this kind of setting. But, you know, it's more guarded, especially seeing, you know, some of the controversy that surrounded you over the years. Just thinks, well, you know, maybe more of the time I'll keep my opinions to myself.
Well, looking at the names that have been mentioned by successor, I don't think any of them is going to have that problem, frankly. I'm very glad of that.
You're not worried about that. Well, I know that many of you will have questions. We have a couple of microphones in the room, so I'm going to try and group the questions so that we waste as little time as possible in getting the microphones round this vast room. So please raise your hands and we will get microphones to you. Thank you, Brian. I'm just going to stand up just to make sure I don't neglect that side of the room. So could we start with the gentleman in the second row here? And then number two, sir, behind. Sorry, is there someone over this side? And can we make three over, gentlemen on the far side there, and four gentlemen there.
Right over there, just in
case. Yes, I know. He's number three.
Number three. Okay.
He's been spotted.
He's been spotted.
Thank you. I could do with some help, though.
Sorry.
Sir.
So, Archbishop, thank you very much. And I did tweet this, but I just wondered what your implications are of your remarks on relationality and personhood with regards to debates where human personhood is very much problematized. And I'm thinking very specifically of debates like abortion or embryonic stem cell research.
Thank you.
Sorry. I've forgotten where we were. Yes. Sorry, the gentleman there as well.
My question is similar in sort of pattern, but on a different subject area. Obviously, one of the major things that's happened in the world during your time as Archbishop is the financial crisis and all that's followed it. By referring to Senet, you referred to some of the ways in which your broad argument has application in the workplace. But I wonder if you could possibly say a little more about how you think business would be done differently, could be done differently, could be done better if people in business, knowingly or not, had the kind of conception of one another that you have set out for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, yes.
Archbishop, is there not a circularity in the argument that we are, our personhood is derived from our shared point of contact in God and that we interact with each other as persons? To use Peter Singer's coined phrase, is it not potentially speciesist to say that we, our personhood is that we treat each other as persons and interact as persons?
And finally, Archbishop.
Thank you very much, Archbishop. Just to ask, you made this distinction between the individual and the person, which I thought was very beautiful. I was just wondering where the mindset of tolerance fits. Is it a property of the individual, this individualistic atom, or is it a property of the person?
Thank you. You don't have to answer them in that order, Archbishop. I'll...
Right. Sorry, just making a note. Maybe I can deal with the third question first, the singer reference. Is it right if I sit down? Yes. If I understand it right, is the argument circular in saying our personhood lies in the fact that we treat each other as persons? Only if, I think, we can say that there is the serious possibility of treating non-human individuals as persons in the same way. I'm very wary of this speciesism argument that I know Singer and others use, because you know, I have yet to see what it might mean to relate to something else in creation precisely the way, with precisely the expectations with which I relate to another human being, which does not mean that I therefore treat the rest of creation as instrumental to my purposes, that I don't accord it respect or whatever, but that there is a particular kind of respect which belongs properly to the person who can answer me. The engagement is of a different kind there. So I don't think it's circular. I think it's, in very significant measure, a matter of the observable way, once again, in which we do relate to each other and don't to other members of the animal kingdom, let's say. So you might want to come back on that sometime. Let's take the fourth question, tolerance. I don't really like the word tolerance, if I'm honest. If I say, I can tolerate the temperature in this room, I mean, I can just about put up with it. Tolerance always seems to me in danger of becoming a rather low-level word. And it may well be that, in a strange way, individualism can best be restrained by a tolerance which says, well, you're going to have to put up with other people because in the short term you can't get rid of them. But if you want something a little bit more robust and a little bit more morally imaginative, you might say that it's not simply tolerance we're talking about, it's it's an attitude of rather more positive expectation towards others, rather more imaginative welcome of others, rather more sustained engagement with others. But that requires, I think, a personalist rather than an individualist approach. So I'm not saying we ought to be intolerant, just that we ought to up the ante a little bit when we use this sort of vocabulary, and that tolerance, sadly, is one of the effects of, I would say, an individualist framework which lowers our expectations.
Could I ask you, Dr. Yes. Is respect a good alternative in the same kind of use, or is even respect in the context of tolerance also a little bit passive and a little bit weak?
Respect's not bad, because it does have about it that aura of, if you like, standing on territory that is not my own. Mm. If I say I respect your convictions, I hope if I mean it seriously, I mean, I'm not sure I fully understand this. I recognise there's something different going on, but I'm certainly not going to rush in to trample all over it.
There's still an element of distance, though, which is what you'd rather see the engagement.
And that's where my third stage, if we start with tolerance, go on to respect. I think my reason for liking the word attention is, of course, that the great French philosopher Simone Weil used attention as the most significant moral category. That is a real kind of generous, time-taking focus on someone else that allows me to be changed in the process, too. Could I take the other two questions very briefly? Financial crisis and how to do business better. I've been very struck talking to some people in the city and in the world of the financial services industry when they say, we feel as let down as anybody else by the fact that some of our colleagues behave badly. It's as if they have no sense of responsibility to us, their colleagues, never mind anybody else in the wider world. And quite early on, as the financial crisis unfolded, I can recall a conversation with a very senior executive who spoke about what's now become quite commonplace, the erosion of trust and relation in business. Now, because the patterns of employment in, let's say, the financial services industry are often quite hectic and short-term, you move on quickly, there's less possibility of building up a sense of corporate identity, a sense of responsibility for each other and shared enterprise. That's one place to start, and one place where you sort of drive in the wedge, which when fully driven in, makes your responsibility to the wider society a bit more vivid. You are not there simply pursuing your agenda. Now, how to restore and strengthen that, I'm not sure. It's a long job, but I think that's the kind of diagnosis I'd start with. And I am encouraged to start with it simply because that is what people, some quite young people in the industry, will say about their sense of where they are. And finally, the question about abortion, stem cell research and related matters. Part of my argument, I think, does imply that you are not going to solve ethical issues like abortion by saying it's like having a tooth out, it's simply a material transaction, nor are you going to sort it out by saying, well, we've got to work out when the soul enters the body, and somehow it's all right before and it's not all right after. I would say that as soon as there is what we can call an individual there, we have something that begins to make the claim of a person. That may still leave open all kinds of complex extreme issues about when abortion is the lesser evil or whatever. I just don't want us to somehow to gloss over the fact that we are talking about personal, relational realities here.
Just following on from the point about the financial crisis, I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about your thinking at the time that the cathedral was surrounded by the Occupy protesters last year. At what point did you think something's got to change, you know, this is not turning out as we imagined?
Sorry, this being
the last December with the the occupation of the cathedral?
Where do I start with that? I wasn't, of course, directly involved with this.
But you must have been watching it all.
I was
very
watching
closely.
It with great interest, and I had two main sensations. One was, I have to be honest, a sort of exasperation with a language of protest which was so general as to be undemanding. Rather like that episode in Father Ted, where the priests demonstrate outside the cinema with a placard saying, "Down with this sort of thing." And I just feel we've got to do a bit better than that. And I wanted...
The quality of the protest had been a bit more specific?
Well, what particular changes can be made? I don't think it helps just to say, in those circumstances, we must work for the overthrow of capitalism. All right, start now. What specific changes would you like to see that can be achieved within a finite space of time? And so there was a bit of that exasperation. The other side of it was, and I wrote a bit about it at the time, the fascination of watching some of the dramas and conflicts and worries of the whole society being played out in front of the church, as if the church were a great backdrop, and people projecting onto the church very interestingly. Both the church should not be encouraging this kind of thing, and the church ought to be backing this kind of thing, again with a great vagueness. I'm thinking, well, that's interesting, but what's curious is that somehow the church still acts as a sort of theatre for some of that to be played out and argued in. Yes. So
in this very small space, it was all being played out. Right, and more questions. Yes, so can we come to one here, and is another one on this side of the room? And then can we have two, the gentleman there with his hand up, and three, and right at the back there, four.
Archbishop, it would be very good to hear your thoughts on how Richard Sennett's ideas about apprenticeship might apply more generally to our education system rather than just apprenticeships as such.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yes, Archbishop, I would like to know the whole debate about human sexuality, where that fits in this discussion and in your distinction between the person and the individual, and perhaps even human limits.
Archbishop, you've put before us a beautiful vision, the personalist vision of a Christian understanding of human dignity, and grounded that in Eastern thought, which has a long history, and a bit of Western thought in Augustine, as you mentioned, being attended to by God. I wonder why, therefore, the impression for so many people is a kind of a negative one of the Christian presence and impact in our world through history. And you just have to list the number of people who, or groups of types of people who may have experienced oppression at that kind of at those Christian hands. In other words, why has that personalist vision not worked as fully as it might? And that would be the roots, one root at least, of a kind of modern atheism, a rebellion against that sort of oppressiveness.
Fourth, is there a microphone over there?
Yes.
Yes, great. We'll come to you in the next round, I promise. Go ahead.
Do you think that personhood can be enshrined in law as human rights?
Interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay, let's take those in order, if I may. Apprenticeships. There is, I think, a very tempting fiction that learning can somehow be detached from the relationship between teacher and learner. Quite a few years ago, I remember a rather daft article in one of the intellectual weeklies, which suggested that what we needed in education was fewer teachers and more computers. And I felt deeply unhappy about that, because it seemed to be suggesting that the interaction between teacher and student in the educational context was really a rather secondary thing. What we needed was simply a reliable source of information. And that has no relational quality to it at all. It doesn't allow the learning of skills, facts, whatever, to be somehow embedded in a process of a developing conversation, and therefore a developing person.
So it's on that basis that I would want to spread out the apprenticeship principle and say it's a very, very narrow and inadequate view of education that imagines you could ever replace teachers with some mechanical instrument of simple knowledge exchange. I'm very wary of language like that, which seems to commodify what's going on so much. And I'd much rather talk about how we work better at a relational model of educating. I suppose that one thing that we all value, don't we, in the way most primary schools work, is that they are strongly relational environments, where the kind of focus on relation matters immensely. And that inevitably gets watered down as people move on in their educational lives, but we shouldn't allow that to take our minds away from the importance of that relational quality in learning, I think, and how we keep building that in, keep drawing people back to it when the temptation is to stick with the knowledge exchange model in a rather mechanistic way. That's a big challenge for every educationalist, left or right. You know, this is not an ideological divide as such.
But maybe less of the TV-style apprentice, then.
Could be.
Maybe.
Could be. Now, a question about sexuality, persons and individuals. Again, there could be hours more of discussion, I think, of this very intriguing question. But I think that to connect what I've been saying with issues around sexuality is really a very, very interesting, very significant bit of the discussion. We do not simply, as a human race, again, what do we actually do? We do not regard sexuality as just a functional matter. We regard it as something to do with relation, with time-taking. We have at the center of our practice and ethics and culture a model of long-term relationship in which sexuality is interwoven with other kinds of exchange, other kinds of conversation, once again, other kinds of creating an environment for one another. We don't just treat it as functional. We don't just treat it as the release of tension. We don't just treat it as a way of getting babies. And it's bound up with our personal lives, and it's not surprising, therefore, that it's the focus of such a lot of anxiety as well as such a lot of flourishing. I think it just bears out the point, really. An individualist approach to sexuality would be one that was simply about the release of my tension, in which, bluntly, all sexuality was really a form of masturbation. That's individualism. But a personalist approach to the sexual, I think, requires that sense of, well, what's the time taken? What's the reality of the other? How do needs and desires fit to one another? How do we grow through that? How do we find a language together? The language of lovers, you know. But that being said, why such a negative picture of the history of Christianity? Why doesn't any of this work? I think is what the questioner was really saying. I could cut to the chase and say something about original sin, I suppose, but in which I believe very strongly. But I suppose you'd have to look in some detail at the history of particular moments and particular trends in Christianity. Let me get theological for just a moment. The whole business of God revealing truth to humanity sounds like a wonderful sort of shortcut, a get-out-of-jail-free card. And yet, what it means is that God commits himself to the human world, and whatever is committed to the human world in words and events and images can also be grabbed and distorted by that human world and turned into something rather appalling. Now, what is it in different bits of Christian history that apparently drives people to grab those revealed mysteries and turn them into the means of oppression? It can be profound political anxieties and social disruption. It can be the subtle spread of a kind of, what should I say, a sort of spirit of the age which is negative or self-doubting. Augustine, whom I quoted, is both the most wonderful and exhilarating of all Christian theologians and one of the most troubling. He lives at the end of a civilization in the middle of a massive global collapse. And so he can simultaneously draw out of the treasure of his inheritance astonishing insights about the person, about God, about politics, and yet can turn in his later works, as the world crumbles more and more about him, to say, we're predestined to heaven or to hell, there's nothing we can do about it. Every child born into the world deserves to go to hell. And you read him, you think, that is the voice of an age that has completely lost confidence and vision. And Augustine, who's a profoundly human member of his society, is feeling that negativity in the air. So you have to look at the history and see where it comes and goes. And the very last question about personalism and human rights. As I hinted in my remarks, I think a really robust and creative approach to human rights requires a very, very strong doctrine of human dignity rather than just the sort of forensic claims that sometimes pass for human rights. We really need to have that positive sense to start with. And that's where I think we need a personalist philosophy to get human rights off the ground. Otherwise, we just have, as I say, an infinity of rival claimants to particular tightly defined goods.
I just want to put in just a couple of the questions that are coming in via Twitter. One saying, what effect do you think the mental health, what effect is there on the mental health and well-being of young gay people in this country due to the Church of England's stance on homosexuality?
Right. I think that although the Church has, in recent years, tried quite hard to say we are not condemning a person as such for what their sexual orientation is, and that's a very serious commitment. Nonetheless, there is, of course, a hangover from the feeling that, yes, you're condemned in your entirety for what you are, not for what you do, but for what you are. If people are getting the message that they're condemned for what they are, then, of course, there's a very serious mental health impact. I hope that's not what the Church is doing. I certainly don't think it's what the Church should be doing. I can't guess what the impact is, and it's not... I hope this isn't just passing the buck. It's not just the Church, it is also a climate of homophobia which still exists, very deeply entrenched in bits of our society. So I can only say we have work to do there.
But some people would say that the homophobia is, you know, that the church's stance is pushing the homophobia rather than doing something to counter it.
I think if you look at what we've actually said in the last 10, 15 years, there have been repeated condemnations of homophobia in terms. Repeated condemnations by the highest councils of our Anglican family of violence and discrimination against gay people. We are trying, I think, to catch up with a reality which for a long time we didn't handle at all well.
And just before we come back to the audience, a couple more questions, actually, as it happens, from two of my colleagues. Justin Webb on the Today programme wants to know if you think that atheists ought to be allowed onto Thought for the Day. And the Reverend Richard Coles would like to know who your favourite Archbishop of Canterbury was.
Right.
I couldn't go back to Television Centre, you see, without...
Absolutely.
Without getting their questions.
Atheists on Thought for the Day. What's Thought for the Day meant to do? It's meant to give us some pause in the day's occupations. It's meant to provide some framework for going rather deeper into the issues of the day. It's historically been understood as an opportunity for a religious perspective, which may not otherwise have an outlet in broadcasting, to have some distinctive input. So I think the case still has to be made for an atheist presence there, in that there isn't all that much of a shortage of opportunities for secularist and atheist people to make their point. And I think it's slightly confusing categories to say that atheist as such.
Okay, so that's a no then.
That's a no.
That's a no. Okay. Your favourite Archbishop of Canterbury?
A tie between St Anselm and Michael Ramsay.
I knew it wasn't going to be anyone easy and recent. okay, can we get a microphone to the gentleman in the back who's been waiting, and one to the gentleman right in the front row, and the lady here. So can we do one, two, here, and then three, and yes, gentleman right in the middle of that section there, you're four. Thank you.
Hi there. Thank you very much, Archbishop, for your talk. I wondered whether you think that your distinction between the person and the individual might have implications for how we practice our politics. It seems to me that we live in an age where citizenship is often thought of along quite individualistic lines in the way that you described it. And I wonder whether you're quite excited about things like community organizing, different practices of politics, which might provide a more personal model for how we do things.
Thank you, Archbishop. My question is regarding the mystery that you talked about in human relationship. We all react in different ways to mystery, and one way is fear. And I think it's the fear of the other, or the other who's unknown, or who's different from us, or who's very culturally different, and things like that, that causes various reactions. That could be violent, that could be, harming, and that limits human potential. How do you think through theologically, both within the church and in the society, that could be helpful in overcoming that fear, particularly with this mystery of the other?
Thank you. Lady here.
Yes, thank you. I've been wondering on this whole sort of thing about homosexuality whether one of the New Testament principles that might be looked at was the one that gave rise to the Pauline and Petrine privileges. I've never been able to remember what the Petrine one was, but I'm just wondering, because I think behind that was the idea that people should be entitled to live in peace in their relationships. Could I have your comment on that? Thank you.
Thank you. And the fourth is the gentleman right in the middle of this row here. We're with his hand up now. Thank you.
Evening, Archbishop. I'm looking for your mindset on the activities of American Christian missionaries in Muslim territories.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. Right. They don't get any simpler, do they? Implications for politics. I was very glad to hear the mention of community organizing. I think I've sometimes been tempted to want to see a campaign for real politics. That is, for encouraging precisely the community organizing tradition. And some of the government's localism agenda, as first presented, seemed to open up the possibility of rethinking some of that tradition. And I hope we can pick up that and run with it and say the most important thing about politics is shaping and nourishing active citizens at every level. That is, people who have some serious sense that what they do and say has a creative role in their own communities. And out of that, I think, comes a healthier national politics, taking the sort of consumerist and, again, functionalist rhetoric and practice out of a lot of our political practice. We've a long way to go, but I'm very glad that there are such organizations, such networks as community organizing, which seek to do just that, to create citizens and work with that. Mystery and fear, and how to overcome fear. You're quite right. The mystery of another person, never mind somebody who is a stranger in all sorts of other ways, the mystery simply of another person can at times reduce us to terror and inarticulacy. When people are in love, there are moments of terror at the otherness of the other, as well as ecstasy and all the rest of it. And what gets us beyond that is, first of all, I think, the kind of openness which says, for all the fear, I still need what another may give me, and perhaps they need what I have to give them. Can we move from the paralysis of fear to say, well, either I starve or I risk. Either I starve or I risk. And in something I wrote recently, I quoted that remarkable incident in one of C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, where the little girl is desperately thirsty, and next to the spring sits the great lion. And she says, would you mind going away while I come to the spring to drink? And he says, sorry, it's the only spring available. You die of thirst or you take the risk. And that's one of the things we have to say to our fear and the fear of those around us. We actually do need one another. And that has something to do with whether or not we have a sense that we are already, once again, in relation to, held by, attended to by what's not ourselves, a faith that allows us to take those risks. A very interesting question on the New Testament and sexual relations. And I think the question was, why isn't it just about letting people live in peace in their relationships? Yes? It's a great mistake, I think, to imagine that the world is full of people who are simply waiting with bated breath to hear the church tell them what to do in their sexual lives. And very often, realistic pastoral practice is about living with, accepting the decisions people have made, and where they need you to be alongside them supportively, to be alongside them supportively. And I think that, you know, that's, pastorally speaking, where we all have to be. In the New Testament and elsewhere, it remains the case that there is a thought-through approach to certain kinds of sexual relations which see them as symbolically central to the Christian enterprise, which sees them as carrying a weight of meaning that not every relationship has. And how you hold on to that sense of the significance, the symbolic significance, the interpretative significance of these particular relationships, marriage especially in the New Testament, without just saying, and none of the rest matter, is both a pastoral and a theological issue which we struggle with. But living in peace, well, as I say, so much of it is, whatever you think of the decisions people have made, respecting, perhaps once again, where they've come from, and trying to start from there. And the last question was about American Christian missionaries in an Islamic context. I wish I knew more about the context of the question, but let me just make a general comment here. Christian mission is always something less than it should be, other than it should be, when it simply goes in to a strange context with no sensitivity to what language is spoken, what culture is around, and assumes that it's always just bringing light into darkness. Christians want to spread the gospel. They want to illuminate people's lives with what they believe they've been given. But right through the history of Christianity, that's involved, I think, a painstaking attention, sorry to use the word yet again, to what is really there. What worries me most about some practices that some American groups have developed in recent years is not only that they seem so deeply to alienate some of those they seek to serve, but also they ignore the complicated position of Christians who are already there. And sometimes the interests of Christian minorities, vulnerable minorities in these settings, are not at all served by aggressive, insensitive language and behavior from Christian missionaries coming from outside who have no idea what's going on locally.
Archbishop, we are nearly out of time. If I may conclude, I just want to ask you one final question, which is that given the very serious divisions and differences that face the Anglican Church, whether it's homosexuality or women, do you feel that you leave the church in a worse place than where it was when you found it? I mean, as Archbishop, rather than when you found the church.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there is no golden age in the church's history. We may think, oh, it was relatively problem-free then. One of the advantages in this job of being a church historian is that you know that's not true. And when I think I've got problems, I think, well, at least it isn't the 4th century, at least it isn't the 17th century, you know.
I suspect there have been many moments where you have been forced to reflect on the very long picture.
One or two, but because... Oh, here we go. Time for personal confessions. Because I'm a Christian and I believe in God... Surprise, surprise. I believe that the church is not just in my hands or the hands of the hierarchy. The church goes on as a creative, spirit-sustained enterprise among believers who commit themselves to this at every level, and the privilege of having some sort of leadership position is just to make sure that you know, your nose is thoroughly rubbed in that reality day after day and week after week, and you remember that's what matters. And, well, what the headline issues are will change from decade to decade, but I actually believe that if God has called this community into existence, God is faithful to what he's done, and that's an end of it.
Okay. Archbishop, thank you so much.